Hello and welcome to the Unbundled Attorney Mastermind Podcast. My name is Dave Ahrens and I'm the co-founder and CEO of Unbundled Attorney. In this podcast, we interview many of our provider attorneys, as well as some of the leading experts in the industry to isolate the best practices for building internet-generated leads and how to ethically and effectively offer unbundled legal services and other more affordable options in your practice. For more information about our services, visit www.unbundledattorney.com. All right, welcome to the show. And this is going to be one heck of a show because we had a conversation with provider attorney Austin Andematin. He is a newer provider attorney for Unbundled Attorney and a newer attorney, graduated a couple years ago as of the date of this recording. We had a really wide-ranging conversation. We cover a lot in this episode. But one of the things that we talk about is the options he's offering and the potential that he has to start offering more options to serve more folks. Up to this point, he'd only been offering full representation to clients that have contested matters and unbundled only for uncontested cases. And one of the things that I invited him to consider and to look into in his state, which is Massachusetts, is the limited assistance representation training, because the state bar offers a program in his state that allows him to get more information about the types of limited assistance, unbundled options that he can offer to clients that may not be in a position to afford either a full retainer up front, or if they can afford that, in order to bring the case fully to fruition from A to Z. And so as a result, some clients have ran out of money somewhere in the middle. And so unbundled really is a way for client and attorney to limit the scope of the involvement so that from the get-go, they can reserve a lot of the funds by allowing the client, empowering the client to handle some parts on their own. And the next episode is going to be interesting as a contrast, because the next provider attorney we've interviewed really focuses on unbundled legal services, just like a couple of the other most recent episodes with Matt Beach, Artie Pirania, Marcus Terigian, and some of the other episodes. They've really focused on leading with unbundled legal services. And as a result, the majority of the folks have been retaining them for unbundled. Some then transition to full representation. But so many of them start with unbundled because it's a more affordable price point. And in the early goings, they can do some of the legwork. The client can do some of the legwork to cut down on the cost so that they can save up those resources that, you know, can sometimes be very limited for the aspects of the case that they really absolutely need help with. Because many of the clients, the 67% in, you know, on average of clients that, you know, would be normally filing to and representing themselves in the court, can't afford an attorney to handle the case from start to finish. And that's the reality of the situation, many, many of them. And so this is a way for, you know, attorneys to get involved, assist them, provide advice, provide guidance, but the client to take on some of that as well so they can save those resources and have the potential of being able to take a case from A to Z with the most assistance possible. And so that's why I invite, you know, Austin to, you know, listen to some of the previous episodes, and also we opened up more conversations with him from there. So it's an opportunity for you to also think about the options that you're offering. There isn't a right way to do this. There's obviously the ethical considerations, and you need to research for your local state bar what you can and can't offer, of course. But there's only one way for you that's going to make sense strategically. One of the things that Austin does is he meets with every client in the office. That's just the way he feels is a great way, the best way to really flesh out exactly what's going on with the case and how to serve them. Whereas in the next episode, we're going to be talking to a provider attorney that over half of the clients retain her right over the phone. And she spends more time on the initial consultation on the phone. And as a result, clients retain her over the phone because there's also a commute involved and she's serving a larger region. Less than half actually come in and meet her to sign up. So, you know, you can kind of start to think about what's the right approach for you. And so this is a great episode to kind of create that contrast and that discussion. So with that, let's just get right into it. This interview with provider attorney, Mr. Austin Andematin out of Boston, Massachusetts. Hope you enjoy it. All right, Austin, welcome to the show.
Hi, how you doing, Dave?
Really good. I'm excited to dive in with you because you're one of the attorneys that's been offering both family law and immigration leads. And from what I've heard, it's been going really well. So I'm glad that we're going to get some time to chat today and dive in on how it's been going.
Yeah, happy to be here.
Yep. So maybe a good place to start, Austin, just to give a bit of context, is maybe share a little bit about kind of your background, how you got started in the practice of law, and maybe the area you service and the areas of law you focus on, so anyone that's listening can get to know you a little better.
Sure. I'm 32 years old, but I was barred in 2014. If you do the math, that means I took some time in between undergrad and grad school to try to figure out what it was I wanted to do. I eventually settled on the law just because, first of all, it worked very well with my undergrad degree, but also because I realized I liked advocating for people and helping people. I went to law school. I graduated in a market that's not very forgiving for new attorneys. I couldn't really find a firm that was looking to pick up an attorney that had just graduated. However, I did have a lot of clinical experience in my third year doing defense work. So when I decided to open my own practice, I became a public defender, which helps subsidize it. The pay is not great, but it supports the business model. And Unbundled, which actually reached out to me, which was great because they liked my website. I had never even heard of you guys before that. The result of just over the last couple of months of doing it has turned my basically public defense practice into having a really solid-based private practice.
And I'm happy to hear that. And one of the nice things about working with lead generation and also just having the technology available is that attorneys such as yourselves can really, that are just kind of getting their practice going, can immediately start to see some new clients and kind of bootstrap the business into something that becomes, you know, a steady stream and so forth. So that's one of the real benefits of these types of models, is that you don't have to build up an SEO presence. You don't have to build up a referral base. You can start seeing clients from day one. So I'm really happy to hear that that's been the case for you. Maybe you can talk about how you started with immigration and then have kind of evolved into doing family law. And then we can dive into some more specifics on the differences in which you work with both. One quick question maybe is, just generally speaking, how's it been going for you? Do you have an idea of, you know, recently what your conversion rates are? I know at the very beginning, sometimes is you kind of learn the ropes and get up to speed, but generally speaking, how many clients have you been able to bring in on average or so, and has that evolved somewhat over time?
So generally speaking, recently, in the beginning, I was my conversion rate was very low. I was not handling the leads properly. I was sending out email correspondence, from court or something like that, and was not creating that personal touch. When I was actually speaking with Graham and going over my structure, when I changed that up, I had a much higher success rate. I get, I would say, 99% of the people who send me the leads on the phone, at least. I get them talking to me. And what I do then is I just kind of provide them like kind of a quick consultation over the phone, not so much in depth, but just kind of outlining what their rights are, generally speaking, what their current situation is, where they're heading, what needs to be done, and then I get them into the office. I have had, I would say, 60 to 70% success rate of getting people into the office. And out of those, I would say I have closed at least two-thirds of them, half to two-thirds of them. But with a lot of people saying, well, we need to raise the money, or that, you know, that it's not a dead end. Most of the time when someone comes into the office, it never really ends with a dead end. Usually it will be they're interested in trying to hire me, but they need to manage something in their life first.
Yep, absolutely. And we're talking maybe 2, 3, 4 out of 10 or have been hiring you already on a conversion, you know, from a straight conversion. Then you have, obviously, like you said, a lot of times it's you have to kind of build up the pipeline, people working on getting the resources together, and then they come back later on once they've been able to do so, especially in family law, for when they have, you know, support of family to assist them with moving forward, and then in immigration when you don't have as strict of timelines necessarily, or the immediacy as often as you do in family law, where people have to move forward immediately unless they're getting deported or something.
Right.
So, okay. So, and are you you're a sole practitioner, Austin, or do you have some support staff?
I'm a sole practitioner, no support staff. I have actually gotten to the point where I've asked for help from people at times, but I really am, it's just me. I am my practice.
Yep. Well, we just did another episode with Mr. Les Sandoval out of Albuquerque, New Mexico, and he'll get some part-time help here and there, but he loves working as a sole practitioner and thinks it's a great value to his clients because, you know, the person sitting across the desk when they meet with him is the person that's going to be handling 100% of the case, being there with you in court, and that's not necessarily true in some of the bigger firms where you're getting passed off to an associate or so forth, or, you know, having other individuals doing some of the work on the case. So
Well, Dave, what I do is I give them my personal cell phone number. I try to be there for my clients when, you know, try to answer them immediately when things come in, because you just that's the type of attorney-client relationship that's going to be valued by a layperson, is knowing that when they have a question for their attorney, that they're going to get a response from them. There are times when I regret doing that, but most of the time it works out pretty well. And if, you know, text messages are very effective ways to just kind of give a client an update on what's going on, and, you know, just have that immediacy.
Yeah, you mentioned your contact ratio is, you know, 99% or, you know, way up there, which is awesome, or something close to that. But maybe you could shine a light on, I think you mentioned before, the process you had wasn't quite optimized, and then you made some changes. Can you share a little bit about what those specific changes that you talked with Mr. Scott about that started to make a difference in the contact ratio and your ability to reach more clients on the phone?
Sure. First off, I call them right away. I also do a double call, which is if I call up and the phone doesn't pick up, I don't leave a message, I'll hang up and I'll call back immediately right after again. Usually when someone sees a number called that they don't recognize twice, maybe they're not recognizing it because they're not realizing that it's just from the internet search they did, they'll pick up the second time, and usually they're pretty happy to be talking with me because they're surprised that the attorney that they just contacted just got back to me. Like, you know, I've heard many times, whoa, that was quick. And that's a really nice thing to know that, you know, the person who's looking for an attorney just got there, an attorney calling back. And I just have a conversation with them. It's a very unassuming, undemanding conversation. I just try to find out what's going on. Let them talk. People who are having legal issues are they're feeling lost and they're looking for help. And even just having a reassuring voice, just tell them, you know, listen to them first, is immediately starting to create a rapport and a client attorney. You know, what could be the seeds of a client attorney relationship. If I don't get in touch with them when I call back, I will leave a voicemail. I'll follow up also with an email. But, you know, surprisingly, you know, that immediate call is so much, I tend to get the person on that. Now, there are times when I can't call immediately. There are times, like, let's say, you know, there's something going on with me or my life where I just can't get to that person immediately. Sometimes the client will contact me, you know, they'll send me an email, and I'll respond with that email and then a phone call. Other times, if I haven't heard from the person and I had that lead, I will, if it's been a couple of hours, I won't call them. I will wait till the next day around lunchtime and call them then. I do that because if 4 or 5 hours have gone by, they're probably no longer, you know, on their computer. They're probably, you know, or they're not actively in the attorney mode. They might be doing stuff with their own personal life. And so I think it's more of a success rate if you call during like the lunch hours and people are off work. That's been how I've been handling it. I cannot remember the last time I was not able to get a person at least on the phone. I've been able to talk to everybody since I've done doing that.
By the way, do you receive the text message, real-time SMS alert when the lead comes in?
I do. I get that. And, you know, at first I don't know if I want to pay for this or not. But there's an advantage because I get a lot of emails. I'm on a bunch of different email servers. As a public defender, I actually had to direct my emails from the lists that I was on through that into like little files that I go through when I have some free time, because otherwise I just get bzz, 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 bzz all day long. My email notifications are not, you know, the quickest way to get in touch with me, but with these leads, you know, you're paying for them. It really makes sense to have that immediacy so you can immediately reach back out to the person. So I've been happy with the text messages.
Yeah, this is a really important point. You know, that I think a lot of attorneys maybe miss, because they say, well, I get the leads, I get emails right to my phone, and so, you know, the text messages aren't important. And you really, you know, hit the nail on the head there that, you know, I don't know anyone on the planet that wants to be checking their email or having every single email notify them the moment it comes in. And if they are, you know, I think that I would argue that's a problem, right?
Yeah.
We don't want to have like be constantly looking at your phone every time an email comes in. And when it comes to being effective at contacting clients, literally there is a window there. It's 1 to 3 minutes that literally makes a tremendous difference in the amount of folks you can reach on the phone. And every minute that goes by after that, that number goes down quite significantly, at least on that first call, right? Kind of like you talked about where, you know, the clients go, wow, that was quick. And so, you know, the ability to get the text message on the phone is really important because it makes it so that you can have emails coming to your phone, but you don't have to have the push or the pull notification where you're getting notified all the time, and you're able to make that real-time callback, which, you know, like it's shown for you, can really make a difference in that improving that contact ratio over time.
And Dave, I would say this is that it could be almost kind of a bit of alarming for the person, like, wait, what's going on? I can't believe the attorney's already calling me back. So sometimes what I'll do is when they go, well, that was quick, right? If it's like that type of time, I'll say, yeah, you know, I got your information based upon the website search you did. It comes to me directly. And generally, my experience is when people have legal issues and they're looking for an attorney, you know, they're definitely needing to talk to one immediately because they need to know what's happening. And so I'm calling you up and see if we could talk and maybe get a chance for us to meet and talk face to face with that. And I never charge for first time consultations. So that immediately takes away a lot of the hard sell oppression. I mean, I don't think attorneys should do hard sells anyway, but it takes a lot of that anxiety person might feel that, oh, an attorney's contacted me off a website search. I did that. Sometimes a person will have a bit of an anxiety from that because if you call them back so quick. But just by saying that, letting them know I'm just here to talk to you is really important, I think.
Yeah, absolutely. And in other ways, I think it almost exceeds their expectations in the sense that, wow, I mean, how quick this service worked that I was able to fill out the form and then minutes or even seconds later, I have someone call me back to address my needs. And so
right.
You know, what a lot of attorneys will say when they say, well, that was quick, and he says, yeah, well, it's very important to us to respond to the needs of our clients as quickly as possible.
Sure.
And they go, wow, right? And so you have an opportunity to exceed their expectation from moment one, and that puts you ahead. And then also in that kind of hot zone, they're still in the state of mind and in the emotional state that incited them to have the motivation to take action and actually request assistance, because it can be scary to go on the internet and, you know, reach out for assistance with a case. And a lot of people, that's uncomfortable for them, like you're describing. And so
right. When
they've gotten to the point where they say, you know what, I need help with this, I need to do something and take an action to do that, you know, that's a really good time for them to continue, for you to be able to make the connection, discuss their case and move them forward, because that's in the position where they're feeling the most empowered to do something about the situation that they're dealing with.
Right. And yep. I'd say, like, it's, you know, I've had a much higher success rate in closing when I got rid of consultation fees. I tried to do consultation fees in the beginning because I was thinking in terms of, oh, well, I'm paying for the lease. I got to try to cover what was, you know, what was spent. I think that is a penny wise, dollar foolish approach in retrospect. It's much better that you cannot just to get the person in the office and to speak with them. It doesn't even matter if they sign with you or not. I mean, it matters, but the fact that they've had that experience is something that's going to translate into referrals down the line, and something that's going to translate into increasing your network and your exposure within communities that are underserved. And I think that that's the proper way to go about it, is just to give a little bit away at first with a soft touch, and then, you know, and then when the person's ready and has the financial means, they're going to go with you because they will appreciate the fact that you just were able to listen to them.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, that most attorneys that we've worked with over an extended period of time have moved in that direction. And a lot of attorneys have tested, you know, do I have an assistant, just call them for me, or do I charge a consultation fee? And we find most will evolve towards, you know, certainly doing the first call, you know, giving the client an opportunity to speak with the attorney, but, and also many of them offering that free consultation, because they start to see the long-term value of each client, not only in the ability to, first of all, build a relationship first, because they don't know your firm yet, it's not a third-party referral, but also, you know, that client's going to continue, you know, be a long-term relationship, and then later on, you start getting referral business from these clients, and, you know, there's so much, I don't know if it's the right phrase, but back end money in the clients that so many attorneys may lose or may not fully take into consideration because, like you said, they're focused on that short term, getting the return on their investment so quickly in the short run, and not investing, you know, properly in the long term relationship and building mm-hmm. a relationship with the client up front. So that's great that you see that too. Okay, so maybe switching gears. So you make that first call, you make contact. Maybe you can talk just a little bit about, I mean, you get into the situation. Do you typically go into the types of options that you offer and make quotes over the phone, or is the main goal just to get them in to meet with you for the first consultation and let them know that that's no charge, and then you discuss fees later, or how do you balance that out?
I don't quote money over the phone. I tried doing that once or twice. It's too much for a client to deal with without having then seeing what you can do for them. It's, you know, the first thing you want to do is kind of lay down what it is that you do. People aren't attorneys. That's why they're looking for one. And so they don't, the average person does not really know what a lawyer does or doesn't really know what situation they're in. They just know that they're in over their head. You wouldn't want a doctor quoting you a price for how much your knee surgery is going to be without him first explaining to you why you need it in the first place and why you shouldn't try to do it yourself. So I try to get them into the office and, the bait, or if you want to call it bait, or the incentive for them to come in is because they're going to get to talk to a lawyer for free. And that's why they do it. You know, I mean, there's a lot of lawyers out there. The ones that are charging consultation fees are, if they've been around forever and they feel like their time is that precious and they don't want to be wasted time, I understand that thinking. But for me, it's, you get them in the office, you talk, I try to find out what's going on with them. You know, I'll get a sense of what's going on with them first. Like, I'll be like, okay, you know, talking with them, they'll say like, oh, you know, the mother of my child won't let me see her anymore. Is your name on the birth certificate? No. Like, okay, so this is a parent in action. You know, we have a person who's not been legally declared the father yet in the eyes of the court, and we got to first get that first. And I just tell them that. And I said, listen, you're in a situation where the state doesn't know you're the father. The money you've been paying to her is not, you know, based upon a court order. You're now going to be going into the court system, and you're going to first have to establish your parenthood. So why don't we come in, we'll talk about what's involved with that. I'll talk about what I could do for you. And you get them into the office, you get them talk more, get more facts. I mean, you know, people want to talk about their problems. You let them talk about the problems, you're going to get a lot of the facts you need to know what's going on with the case. And then afterwards, I'll let them know, you know, okay, listen, you know, maybe you need a separation agreement to be drafted up, and that's what, and I can do that for you as an unbundled attorney service. And, you know, that's a different thing. If you want to hire me as your attorney to get on the case, to handle, you know, to go to the court and handle hearings, well, now we're talking about a retainer situation. Okay, what's that going to look like? And then that's where I've gotten creative, and I've either gotten creative smart or I've kind of gotten creative stupid, and we'll find out in the long run. But what I have done is I've actually adopted a strategy that I saw on one of the podcasts from Unbundled. I'm trying to remember the gentleman's name. I think his first name was Michael, but where I will take, I don't try to get the money for the entire case up front because most people just can't afford that. It's just not economically reasonable. I'll take enough money to cover the initial filings and court appearance. Or, you know, I'll take about $3,000 or something like that. I'll try to take enough to handle the upfront work that goes into a case with monthly payments into the retainer afterwards. And so far, I've had a much higher success in getting people to hire me. There's pros and cons to that. The cons is that you are to an extent extending the person credit, and you know, just because the person stops paying you doesn't mean the court's going to allow you to withdraw. So there's always a chance that you might be stuck on a case where you're going to be, you know, where you will be earning a balance towards that a client will have to pay back down the line, and whether or not they're going to get, that's a question. But for me, income capitalization right now is key to my practice. More, you know, so just having that initial amount come in is very important. And I see it as a situation where, you know, if you develop a good relationship with the client, if you see them start to make monthly payments, you're in a pretty good situation. And what my experience is, if the client realizes down the line that they can't afford you, like if they start to see, you know, you explain to them that this is, that there's going to be monthly payments, this is kind of cover initial work, and then they see like, okay, this is what an attorney costs, they'll be just so happy that you did the initial filings. They'll be so happy that you got the ball rolling that they'll just say, you know, I think I could take it on my own now. I think I can handle the situation on my own. I think now you filed what was filed, and now I'm going to go in and argue. And they'll just say, thank you so much for what you've done, but I don't want to be paying for an attorney anymore. And then you withdraw and they assent to it. I've had that a couple of times, and it's always on good terms. But, you know, that they appreciate what you've done, but they just really can't afford you anymore, and they don't want to be paying the monthly payments, and they don't want to be getting into debt. So they ask you to leave. Right. And that's great. I mean, that is in a sense kind of like a quasi unbundled attorney service, you know? So that's the model that I've developed as far as family law goes. It's been working. It's a bit of a risk as far as, you know, whether or not a client will not be so understanding and not be paying their bills. And, you know, if I find that down the road that I'm getting into situations where there's large balances that are being unpaid, then I might have to rethink that. But so far, it has helped me bring in clients that otherwise would not be able to retain an attorney because they just can't raise $5,000 up front.
Right, exactly. And so maybe we can get a little bit more clarification, and I know you're still evolving the options that you're offering both on the unbundled side and the retainer side. But I want, but maybe you can be a little bit more specific about, you know, when you actually meet with the client, how do you go about kind of determining it? Are you kind of asking, you explain to the client, okay, well, we have two different paths. We can go here. Either I can, you know, perform some work for you, do these tasks, and then you can proceed from there. And, or you can hire me to do, you know, A to Z and so forth. Or how do you kind of, or do you first determine where they're at financially and then suit something to that? I mean, how do you kind of figure out whether it's going to be an unbundled service or a full representation service in the initial consultation? Then we can talk more about the options from there.
Sure. So I will just kind of, after I get a sense of what the case is about, I will just say, well, let's talk about the different things that I can do for you and the different options you have. And I do that. I pretty much do that with every client. You know, when, if a client's financial situation is really tough, then even raising $3,000 or $2,000 for an initial retainer is going to be like, what? I don't think I can do that. And you'll get a sense of that. You know, I haven't gotten set up to do credit checks yet. I haven't been, you know, that's something I'm looking into. You know, this is kind of a new process for me. So that's something that might help me mitigate my risks a little bit more. But generally, I've just been going based upon, I try to find out what the person makes. I try to get to find out what the person's income is. And, you know, and based upon that, I've been making decisions on that. But what I'll do is I will offer both. My experience is that once they come in, they sit down, they talk with an attorney, and they realize there's somebody that is, you know, competent to go going forward. They will, and because I'm a new attorney, my rate is a lot lower than other attorneys. I'm competitively priced at my hourly rate. So and I let them know that's why it's lower, is that because I'm a recent attorney, so that they, you know, so that they understand that that's the situation they're getting into. And it doesn't really matter for a lot of the people that I represent, because they're coming from an income bracket that has made the assumption that that an attorney isn't for them. That they can't afford one. That they're just shit, you know, out of luck, and they're going to have to deal with you know, with the situation on their own. When they realize that they're talking to an attorney and that he's going to work with them financially, I usually find that people are very willing to enter into that relationship and prefer to be in a retainer A to Z representation. Even if later on they decide that they can do the rest on their own. And if a person's going out on their own, you know, I'll give them kind of like some, you know, I'll give them some going away tips, like, all right, well, this is where you're at. This is what you need to do going forward. And if you just change your mind down the line, or if you want to come back and hire me again, that door is always open. I actually have not had many unbundled representations. Most people, after they talk with me, they want to hire me. They don't want to hire me just to draft something up. They after speaking with me, they decide they want me talking for them in court. That's just been my experience. You know, I always offer it. I always offer it because, you know, that's part of what drew them to the representation in the first place, was the idea of like, oh, you know, I won't have to pay for the full representation. I'll pay for a little bit. But when they realize that, hey, man, maybe it's manageable. Maybe I can make this work. They will do that. So.
Yep. We found that to be the case for most attorneys. It's you know, 2/3, 3/4. Usually, once they realize what's involved with, you know, bringing their case fully to fruition, they start to realize that maybe they really need to do what they can to come up with the full amount. And that's where you can start working with them, you know, within payment confines or payment budgets or arrangements that are more creative to work around their budget to allow them to continue to do so. And we can talk a bit more about how you've been doing that. You know, one of the things that's interesting about, you know, the region you're in Massachusetts, is they've been one of the on the forefront of kind of promoting, you know, in Massachusetts, unbundled legal services is referred to as limited assistance representation. There's a whole division of the bar called the LAR that, you know, trains on these types of things. Can you shine, as far as to your knowledge, I don't know how much you've looked into that or if you've gone through the training yet, but what are the types of options that you would typically offer someone on a more limited assistance or unbundled basis? You know, is it document preparation? Are you given the opportunity to do a limited appearance, or maybe you can kind of share a little bit about what those options would be if a client is to choose to kind of limit the scope of the involvement down to just specific tasks?
one of the things that I would offer would be document preparation. I would offer, you know, if it's an uncontested divorce where both parties are looking to you know, stipulate and jointly file, that's something that is very easily handled by by an attorney as a limited assistance representation, because you get the separation agreement together, you get what's needed, you get all the paperwork, and then you just hand it to the client and say, okay, listen, you go to court, this is what you both are agreeing to, you talk to your client, you say, you know, this is what rights you're giving up, this is what rights you're protecting, this is why this agreement can work for you, or this is achieving your goals that you told me your goals were, and sometimes you can even meet with both parties, explain to the other party that, you know, you're representing your client and your client's interest, but this is the agreement, and you can take this to your own attorney to get a look at it. Sometimes they do, sometimes they don't. You get that together and you send them on their way, and that's maybe what people need. They just need the documents put together, need the proper filings, and they can go in and say, yeah, we're not really divided much, and yeah, we have a kid, but this is how we want to do it, and we both agree, and everything's in agreement. The court goes, okay, you agree. Okay, I'm looking at the child support guidelines. Okay, they're good. Looking at the custody arrangement, it doesn't seem to trigger any concerns. There's no criminal records for either party. Boom. You process it, you know, and that's something that can work for people. I haven't had to do that yet because my experience so far has been that people want to hire me as their attorney for the handle of the case. I have one lead that very well might be that type of relationship, but he needs to first make sure that it is an appropriate case for joint filing. So he hasn't hired me yet because I explained to him what joint filing means, that everything all the issues have to be in agreement. He's going to speak to his spouse, see if she's open to the idea of, having me draft it up. He'd pay for it, and then she can come in and look it over, and see, you know, if she agrees. And obviously, she'd have the right to go get her own attorney. That is something that might come down the line, but I haven't had to do that yet. I've been hired, which is a great, great thing.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So you haven't also done a limited assistance representation yet on a contested case where
I have to look into how that works with family law and the courts. Some courts you just write LAR, and it's clear that you're just representing them for the day. Mm-hmm. I had a case in Bristol County where I was looking at the potential of doing a limited assistance representation. And apparently, in that court, they require you to be certified LAR. So the court systems are all little microcosms. I got to kind of look into how that works so that I can make the most of that. That's something that's in the pipeline, but I haven't gotten there yet.
Well, you're fortunate because you're in one of the few states that actually has a certified program that trains on these types of things as well. And then, of course, you know, with our podcast and all the other attorneys that, you know, we're interviewing and all the attorneys in our network that have, you know, a great deal of experience offering these types of options in an ethical and effective manner for folks that are of limited means, that, and they're just handling parts of the case and then, you know, advising folks on how to handle the rest from there. There'll be a lot of opportunities for you to start exploring those options as well. But let's talk a little bit about the folks that maybe we could get a little bit more specific on, the ones that, you know, hire you for full representation. You know, let's say that they maybe don't have the $3,000 up front. So typically you would normally ask for around $2,000 to $3,000 as a full representation retainer.
I've been asking for $2,000, and recently I decided that I'm going to make it more for a full representation, just because the costs of the initial costs can very quickly get up to about $3,000. And that's what I'm trying to cover, is the initial work that gets a case started. Because once you're in the court systems, and once your case gets rolling, you know, the initial filings happen, and then there's a period of time where, you know, the case has gone going, there's a hearing here, there's a hearing there, and then, you know, eventually, you know, the very well might be a big trial. That works very well with the system where a person's paying into the retainer over on a monthly basis, but you got to get over that initial hump. And if the person doesn't think they can afford you after the initial hump, they're going to ask that you get off the case. That's just financial realities. They're going to be like, oh, just to get to this point, it costs, you know, the retainer's been diminished, and now I'm paying monthly, but I'm going to be in debt to my attorney. Some people will accept that and understand that they're making an investment. Others will, just decide to handle it on their own from that point, and that's fine. The issue for me, it's like I need to get that initial amount. They understand it, and there's really not. I mean, that I don't really, you know, either they have that money or they don't. That's where I'm at right now. I don't, I'm open to any other creative ideas as far as trying to help them raise that money, but I don't, you know, I don't think you can take loans out to pay for legal fees. I don't think anybody would back that up. So that's what I ask for, is for that initial amount for full representation.
And if the client doesn't have the $2,000 to $3,000, have you offered a lower retainer, a starting kind of rate for specific steps, or is it that's what you need to get started, and then they pay monthly from there if they're going to continue to work with you?
I am willing to get, you know, there's stuff, there's work that needs to be done on the case prior to filing the complaint or filing, like if entered a notice of appearance, I'm willing to take less in order to try to do the initial work to figure out first, you know, sometimes there's work that needs to be done before a case even gets filed, just to know if the case should be filed. You know, there's situations where like the client doesn't know how they got into the situation they're in. You know, there's document requests that you have to do, and institutions you have to get information from. DCF investigations, for instance, are things that aren't necessarily before the courts, but the DCF is now engaged in the family and doing an investigation. Maybe they need an attorney to step in between them and DCF and protect their rights. That's something that's very, very open to a lower retainer type of situation. But if I'm entering a notice of appearance and if it's not on a limited basis, you know, I need to know that I'm covering the costs of, you know, those first two court dates and the work that's going into drafting the documents for that. It's easier if they're in an answering position, if they've had things filed against them and now you're answering on that. It's just, you know, but if you're the one drafting the complaint and you're taking all those first steps, you know, you also have to cover the cost of filing. That's the other thing, you know, I mean, there's filing costs are coming right out of the retainer. So, you know, you got to take all those things into consideration.
You know, what's coming up for me, Austin, at this point is, you know, I think there is some room for, I mean, and it's great that you're already doing so well up till now with the model you've been utilizing, because if you were offering, you know, all these different other limited assistance representation options and you were showing the numbers that you are, that would be awesome. But you're doing primarily a full representation retainer on every contested case and then offering limited assistance when only an uncontested. And I think from what we've learned from the attorneys that consistently convert 50, 60, 70% of the clients is there's a very common in-between, which is where they're evaluating and conversating with the clients on what it really takes to bring a case to fruition.
All right.
And then structuring an arrangement from the get-go that takes that into consideration so that they're never in a position where they have to then go off the record because the person runs out of money.
Mm-hmm.
That would be quite unusual with most attorneys that you work with, because the idea is to work with the client in such a basis that they can afford to bring the case fully to fruition. And sometimes that's not always possible. You have trials, you have highly contested matters, and these things go on for a lot of hours.
Right.
But I guess the way in which attorneys have found it possible to do that is empowering the client to handle as many of the initial tasks. If it's determined early on that finances are going to be a limitation, so that they can preserve those resources in the short run so they can last further in the long run and potentially still have some gas in the tank to have the attorney, you know, do the litigation in the end of it when they absolutely really need that lawyer to make the difference for them in court.
Right.
And so it'll be really interesting for you, for the LAR, and listen to some of these other podcasts, I think there's probably even – you know, you're having, you know, 2, 3, 4 out of 10 retaining you and some more in the bank, and that's excellent. But if I were to guess, there's probably even another 3 to 5 clients that are still on the table that, you know, aren't able to come up with the $2,000 to $3,000 up front. That would be probably the first barrier. And then the second barrier would be that, you know, they're realizing they can't afford it to go all the way through, and therefore not starting. Right. And
right.
Maybe that doesn't come into communication on the phone or with you, and they go, okay, well, we'll think about it. But, and so it isn't immediately identified as that, but that's the characteristic we find for most of our attorneys that converts so highly, is that they've found ways to even work with the contested clients, the ones that have, you know, issues where it's clear that they're not going to make agreements, just to have kind of a partnership between the client and the attorney and work with them on a limited assistance unbundled basis and have that client, you know, be performing some of those tasks pro se, especially in the early goings, to preserve their resources financially until when it's really needed.
That's really interesting. You know, I'm kind of learning as I go the whole system, you know, and so of course I'm always open to any suggestions you might have. But
well, this is great, man. I'm really I'm really glad that we're jumping on the phone right now, because this is really what we're all about, is not only, you know, providing the leads and you know, giving you guys a great stream of business, but also providing the resources, the community and the network and these calls, so that attorneys such as yourselves can get the experience from attorneys that have been doing this for years and learn the best strategies for, you know, being effective at offering these options, not just to family law, but immigration. And so, you know, that's, you know, one of the things that makes this network and this community great, is that you do have these resources and all these other attorneys available to learn from. And in your state, even, you know, the state bar has programs that can educate you on it as well. So we will continue certainly to, you know, explore this further and be in touch. And the podcast episodes we've just released with Marcus Derigian and Les Sandoval and some of the others that come out, that are coming out soon here, will also be super helpful as well. So maybe what we can do is switch gears a little bit and talk about, as we've been talking about family laws, talk about immigration.
Sure.
And just kind of draw a comparison between the family law clients, you know, being more of kind of an emotional type of situation, obviously, especially if they've been served paperwork and so forth, versus the immigration clients, and kind of what the time factors there are and what you've found are the key, the main differences between the two, and how the process you've developed differs depending on the type of client.
Sure. So when you deal with immigration, there's the first question is what agency are you dealing with? Are you dealing with USCIS? Or are you dealing with ICE? You know, Immigration Customs Enforcement. People who are dealing with ICE, who are dealing with removal issues, they're going to be just as emotional and upset and distressed as a person dealing with family law, if not more so. But that, I have not actually seen a lot of referrals from unbundled for cases dealing with ICE. That's not surprising. A lot of people who are facing deportation just are also just not plugged in enough to know how to obtain attorneys. So that's why the PAIR project exists. So the majority of the people that I get through unbundled are people who are looking for help with marriage applications, looking to petition for a family member that's abroad. So the way I handle that situation is I first talk to them, and, you know, and of course the goal of any first call or communication is to get the person into the office. However, I do notice with marital applications, they want to know more up front. They know that there's a wide market out there. You're also, in a sense, are competing with a black market, which is the notarios, who are do service a lot of communities. You know, albeit illegally, but they do service a lot of the community. So you are, in a sense, you know, being undercut by them on that specific issue, which is marital applications. With those cases, and I've gotten quite a few, or, you know, a good couple of them from unbundled, I will get them, you know, I'll try to bring them into their office, explain to them the process. I try to first immediate issue is just to run through a series of questions to determine whether or not there's any admissibility issues. Right. That's key. I will do that on the phone first. And if they're demanding a price, and sometimes they demand a price, I will get a first, before I even give a price, say, well, it depends on whether or not there's any complications. Oh, there's no complications. Well, let me ask you this. You know, how did you come into the country? Did you come in through, you know, a visa? Did you come? And I try to get that, deal with those admissibility issues first. So if I can narrow down the fact that there's no admissibility issues and that the marriage is, been together for a little bit of time, but there's, you know, it's not like literally they were dating a month and then got married, because that will usually result in a request for further evidence. At that time, I will just, I'll give them a quote. I try to make it about $1,100 on those type of cases. Flat fees are the norm in immigration practice. Mm-hmm. What I do to try to work with the clients, sometimes clients can't afford $1,100, $1,200 up front. I will pay, I'll ask for half at the opening of the file, at which point there's responsibilities upon the client to obtain lots of the documentation that's going to be needed. And I'll let them know what that is. I give them a little to-do list, a little homework list. You know, I can get the I-94 easily from a passport, but, you know, the birth certificates, translations of birth certificates, that's a lot of stuff that I put on the client. And, you know, I'm able to get translations for them, but my experience has been, and I always tell clients that are from immigration populations here, is that they're actually able to get it cheaper than I am. They'll know somebody that can do a certified translation. The person that I use or the people that I use will give me lawyer prices. And my experience is that people who are in immigrant populations will know somebody who can do a certified translation and will get a cheaper price because they're not the business. So I give them that option and that opportunity. Or if not, if they don't know anyone, then I'll do it. I'll get help through a person that does a certified translation for me. Get the certified translations, all that, you know, and then I'll ask for the second half before I file the application.
Yeah, and do you, and this is something that, you know, you kind of mentioned briefly, is that they, when they're calling in, they're, a lot of times the immigration clients are trying to get a price. They want to know the price. And so
Right. Well,
some other attorneys have said that they've had to, you know, deal with that, because that's a lot of times what the person's asking for immediately. And so how one of the things it sounds like you've done is, or had to resist against, is quoting until you really have an understanding of what's going on. But then it also sounds like you have to be pretty direct in exactly what it is going to cost, correct?
Yeah, that's exactly what it's like. It, you know, again, the lead's going to dictate that. Some people will be okay with the idea of coming in and talking with you and figuring out the price later. But, you know, the person goes, well, how much is this going to cost? I say, well, it does depend on. So, yeah, but I just like, just tell me how much it'll cost. Like, well, for a non-complicated case, and there are many different things that can make it complicated, for an uncomplicated case where I don't see any issues for admissibility, for you know, that can tell you, oh, my, you know, we're great. I'm like, all right. And those type of cases, this is how much it would be. And I just picked that flat rate because I look at how long it's taking me to do other cases. And, you know, it's funny, there are great discrepancies in how much legal time you put in from case to case. You know, some cases are so easy and the people just get you exactly what they need. And other cases turn into complete nightmares where you have to, at a case where the marriage fell apart in the middle of the application, and that became a nightmare because everybody's, you know, and I had to withdraw from that case, and that does happen. And so you kind of are trying to, the clients don't understand this, but when you're paying flat fees, you're not only just paying for your representation, but you're paying in a sense for everybody else's representation that came before you and the calculus of what that estimate is. That's, you know, I just pick a flat fee and I'm trying to get $1,200 per marriage application that are not complicated. And that's just the amount that I settled on based upon the amount of time I averagely will put in.
Yeah. And have there been times when you've had to say, you know, look, you know, I really have to find out more about exactly what your situation is before I'm going to give you a quote, because there can be some things here that
absolutely,
you know, are going
absolutely
to be really prohibitive. Yeah, you have to come in the office. We need to meet. We need to talk. You know, and I think Sue talked about that as well, where for their protection, you can't, you know, get into the details specifically in certain cases until they really take a closer look at what's going on.
Well, I'll give you a classic example. It's like, well, have you ever been arrested by police? Yeah, I was arrested, but they let me go. Okay, what was it related to? It was a drug thing, but it was dismissed. Well, dismissed can very quickly mean quaff in Massachusetts. And quaff, continuation of the finding, is a factual finding that results into triggering removal provisions within immigration law, which means you need a waiver before you can even ask for any benefit. In fact, the person might actually be deportable right then and there. You can't quote a price on that. You can't quote a price on that. And in fact, in that type of situation, that's a great opportunity for unbundled representation, where I bring the client in and I say, listen, you got these outstanding issues. We got to find out first off what's going on with you. So I need to go down and get the docket from the court. I need to look at the docket. I got to look at the immigration law behind it. And we got to decide whether or not, first of all, you've triggered any removal issues and whether or not you qualify. And I say that a little bit less legalese and a little bit more generally. That's a great opportunity to do a flat fee representation, just to help the person understand their current legal situation. Just because you marry an American spouse does not necessarily mean that gates of immigration benefits open up to you if you got other issues with you. And so I use that as an opportunity to do a fact-finding representation first, and then be able to advise them better later, because that's what they really need at that point, is they need to understand what they're dealing with. There's another issue with immigration representations. Immigration is one of those areas where, like, it's interesting. Family law, it's the courts are cultural. So you're dealing with culture when you go into court, but when you deal with the client, you can explain to them the law, and, you know, there's a rapport there. Immigration is the opposite. The law is very categorical. But the client is where the culture has to be dealt with, you know, because there's cultural differences, and, you know, you kind of have to manage expectations, and this sometimes is an effect where that the idea that the advice you're given sometimes has to be, I can't help you. That does happen a lot. In fact, that was, you know, that is a bit of an issue sometimes with, you know, unlike family law leads, where there's always something you can do for the client, with immigration leads, sometimes there isn't you can do. You know, sometimes clients coming in, they're like, yeah, you've been deported twice. And not only can I not get you the benefit you're seeking, but you can go to jail and then get deported, right? That there's nothing I can do for that person. For me to do anything for them at that point would be, in my opinion, malpractice, because at that point I'm putting them in danger. You know, unless they can qualify for some type of waiver. So, you know, that often a lot of times, is, you know, that has to be the answer. It's like, you don't have a benefit. It's categorical. But there are, there's this, you know, idea like, well, maybe you're just not the right attorney for me. I got to find somebody who will who will tell me what I want to hear. And, you know, with notarios or just generally unethical attorneys, that will happen a lot, is where money will be taken and nothing will be done. And it's unfortunate that people are preyed upon that way.
Yeah. And it's almost like, you know, there's two steps in immigration. It sounds like step one is, it's, you know, get the information together. And is there a yes or a no? It's like a one or a zero. Do you have a path or do you not? In a sense, it's more transactional, more very clear, a little bit more clear cut, whereas family law is, there's a judge deciding, there's a lot of different variables. Usually you can improve the situation in some way, shape, or form, depending on the facts of the situation. But with immigration, it's kind of like, yes, no, okay, yes, we continue, no, we have to stop there, right?
Right,
you can identify where they have a path.
The first part of the representation is just determining whether or not they there's even need for a representation.
Right.
It really is. I mean, you know, there's a lot of wiggle room, and I'm still learning the ins and outs of it. But it is a statutory scheme. It is a codified legal system. It is categorical in its outlook. You know, when you get into removal issues, yeah, there's a little bit more play there. You got, you know, you can try to use asylum. You can try to use, Convention Against Torture. These are tough things to prove, but they're fact-based and they're evidentiary-based. And those are some things where, you know, where now you're dealing with substantive rights of a person being removed, but, to the extent that they're substantive. But, you know, the issue with, when you make an application, either they qualify or not, people come in, they want to know if they can apply for their sibling. Oh, yeah, I just became an American citizen. I got a sibling I want to apply from. Yes, you can, but it's not going to be like when your spouse applied for you. You're talking about around a 10-year waiting period. You're talking about getting, you know, trying to get them into, a category of that is, a preferential category, but they're not entitled to immediate relief. And so that's an honest conversation you got to have with someone. You got to explain to them the timeline they're looking at. If their brother is 56 years old and has cancer, then they're not really looking at a 10-year, looking at him getting him in 10 years. You know, maybe that's not something that's realistic. Maybe what they're really trying to do is get him over on a tourist visa and have them get some medical treatment or something. You know, that's something that is, something you have an honest conversation you got to have with the client and try to determine that and try to find options.
Yeah. And then when you kind of get that, you know, the yes, no, and then you can proceed from there. It also sounds like immigration lends itself well to kind of breaking things up into steps. And, you know, it sounds like the billing arrangement can kind of mirror and be billed in broken up steps, because each step takes time. There's you do step A, then there's a waiting period, step B, step waiting period. So
right.
It sounds like you have room to be more creative in breaking up each step and each, you know, the full amount into different payment rates as well, right? Different blocks of payments.
Absolutely. Especially on applications that go to the state. And keep in mind when you're applying to USCIS, you know, the representation kind of ends when you mail that application, right? And then if there's further issues down the line, then you pick up and deal with that down the line. But so that's where, you know, that's where there's a really good, all that stuff that leads up to before you mail that application are different little blocks that can be broken up. So while on the one hand is that yes or no, and that's kind of what makes, you know, the immigration leads just a little bit more tenuous, because it's like, okay, maybe this is a no, and I've gotten this lead, but that I can't do anything for the person. But once it's a yes, there's a lot of ways, different variables and ways you can help a person, or ways you can break up the payment so that a person isn't hit, can actually decide they can afford you. So that, you know, you're absolutely right about that. Especially with USCIS applications. A little bit tougher to an extent with, removal, because removal is very much like a criminal defense. Quasi-criminal defense issue, Like they do allow bail only representations, but there's once you're handling a removal issue, you're kind of in for a penny, in for a pound.
Yep. Okay. Right. Exactly. So you have a little bit more creativity with the way you structure things. So the finance has almost become a non-issue because they don't have a need to come up with a huge amount of money because there isn't a huge amount of work that needs to be done in a short time basis, unless it's like you're talking about a deportation case or something right. That has an immediate time factor, right?
Right. And if it's a deportation case, I would ask for everything up front anyway. I would just, because whatever you're not getting, you're never going to get. Because if a person's being deported, so hopefully the family puts the money together, something like that. But, If it's a $5,000 case, and they're like, well, we'll pay you $2,000 now, we'll pay you $1,000 month after month after month. Well, if the person's getting deported, they're not going to be able to pay you. That's the deportation cases are all or nothing type of situation normally anyway.
Definitely. Yep. And then one last question on the immigration is, and I'm not sure how many of these leads you've worked with yet, but have you had some clients or do you have some experience with working with clients that speak other languages other than English? And if so, how have you worked around do you work with a translator? What strategy have you used to work with folks that, where English either isn't their private language or they don't speak English at all?
So my immigration case cases outside of unbundled tend to be within the Brazilian community because my wife is Brazilian and I speak Portuguese working proficiently. And I will use sometimes my sister-in-law who is fluent in both languages. She'll come down and help out with the translation with a confidentiality agreement between me and her. Other times, because you can use people to translate. It doesn't have to be a certified translator for purposes of legal consultations. It's only when you're in court that they have to be a certified translator. People will bring family members, they'll bring friends that can talk for them. I haven't had to. From unbundled representations, I have not had that happen as far as a person not being able to speak English. I imagine it's because in order to be going on unbundled and filling out the application, you're already having some type of language proficiency. I don't even know if unbundled has like little language links and on its page for, say, hey, here, click here for Portuguese, click here for Mandarin. I don't think that it has that. I mean, maybe I'm wrong about that. But so for the immigration clients, generally they're immigration clients that have some type of command for English. I do get a lot of Brazil. What I would do, and I haven't had to do it yet, is if I had a person who didn't speak my language and I didn't have anybody that could translate, I had one person that was Spanish speaker, but again, my wife's sister speaks Spanish fluently too, I would use a translator service. But the issue with that is if you're going to be hiring a translator, well, that's a situation where I would want to have the client, have some type of compensation for that because that's, that could be very expensive. That could be, $100. Now your gratuitous consultation has turned into $100. You're paying $100 to meet with the person for free. That's very difficult. So I usually put it on the client to find somebody to translate for them. Usually somebody knows somebody that speaks English and they'll bring in a friend or a family member. That's just been my general MO.
Yeah, I mean, I would say you're right. The vast majority of the clients that we attract in our immigration are English speaking because of our language settings and the site and so forth. And that's what we focus on. But there are sometimes clients that will come in with different languages. And there's been similar strategies that other attorneys have used where they've had translators involved and made that as part of the arrangement of that initial meeting is, sometimes even on a three-way call with a translator to then have them come in and meet and work around that. And Marcus talks about it on his podcast as well, where he talks about how he's built relationships with translators in the courts and kept all their cards and, had them literally a phone call away for various different languages. So it's interesting to see the ways in which you work around that within the immigration courts.
That's definitely something that's definitely something that sounds really interesting. I'll have to look into it. I'll have to check out Marcus's podcast. Again, I'm always open to suggestions. So definitely looking into that. It hasn't been an issue for me yet. It hasn't been something that has come up, not off unbundled and not even in my private practice because I do have a lot of, usually somebody who, in just my experience within the immigration community who's fluent in both languages, they get enlisted by their friends and families to help speak for them. And they actually, this creates kind of like a sense of pride that they're doing it, So I do find a lot of immigrant clients who don't even speak a word of English, we'll find somebody who can speak for them. That's just
right.
been my experience so far, but I can see how that won't be the case all the time.
All right. Well, I have one or two more questions, and then we'll go ahead and wrap it up here. These are kind of quick questions at the very end.
Sure.
One of the questions would just be, is there any technology that you've used, whether it be a client management software, a payment processing solution, Dropbox, anything like that, that you found to be really useful in your ability to manage the clients? Obviously, you're still getting your feet wet, get the practice going, but have you implemented any technologies that that have been helping you with streamlining your processes?
I have taken Graham Scott's advice on the two issues. I went and got Clio. Clio has been a much superior system than what I was using before. It works very well with Unbundled, first of all, but also just I really, really like how it operates as a software, and it's very cloud friendly. So, and I'm the 21st century attorney. I try to keep myself, even though I have an office, I try to keep myself mobile if I can be, so I can keep doing things and be able to bill time. And the app on the phone is just like, okay, I just had a 12-minute conversation recorded, and that's really nice to be able to do that. I also have LawPay. LawPay has helped me close clients where they say, if I have a client who's, they don't have $4,000 in the bank account, but they do have a good credit line and they want to, use that towards their retainer, I'm right there to do it, and that's a really nice feature to be able to utilize. So the LawPay has been excellent. And the fact that I can use both I was using PayPal before for, the flat fee representations to take credit cards. Well, PayPal works fine with the flat fee representation. It does not work at all with the trust account. So you can't use it, right? And so at that point, it's like, all right, I have to, give me a check or give me cash, and I can't take the credit card. PayPal works with operating accounts, and they works very effectively. So those two things have helped me mentally as far as those two types of systems I've been using. Outside of that,
LawPay can distribute the payment to the appropriate account.
Yes,
or the operating account, right?
And I like that, and my license likes that. So that's really important. Can't be commingling funds. So that allows me to take credit cards for the purposes of retainers, and that is so important.
Yep. And also from an app right on your phone too, right? So similar to Clio.
I can actually do that. I haven't learned how to do that as far as from my phone. I guess you could just enter the information. I just swipe it right into my computer. It's so much quicker. Mm-hmm. I have the little swipe thing from PayPal, and I just have done that. But that's interesting. Yeah, LawPay on app. I gotta get that on the phone. Wow, this has been
mobile.
this has been a good learning experience for me. I've a couple of good pointers. I'm taking notes, so that's good.
Well, everyone else that's listening's been taking notes too, so it's a tick for tack. So I'm glad that everyone's getting value from the call. And so I guess the last question I'll ask is, you've been working at it for a couple months here, but just generally speaking, if you look back and kind of what you've learned, is there anything else, generally speaking, that you've kind of developed either from mistakes you made or successes you've had with fielding the leads that you found to be very useful that either attorneys are just getting started or just generally speaking that you think is a strategy that's worked well for you and over the last few months of working on this project?
Working on this project and just in practice generally, you got to be strategic in what you spend your money on as far as reaching out to clients. I'm now, networking and Unbundled operates very much like a networking approach in the sense that the client comes in and they're looking at what the services are and they send the information and the lead comes in. That is a really, really nice feature that, this person's being directed right to you and then you can come in contact with them. Make sure you're using things that work for you, but you got to spend money on advertising. Otherwise, you're just not going to bring people in. So, I think Unbundled, initially I had some reservations about it. There were certain areas that I was trying to take leads from that I realized weren't working because they're too far away from me right now or too far away for the client to want to pay for travel time. So look at what's working and keep doing what's working. Double down on what's working and what's not working, cut it loose. And so Unbundled's been working for me. So far, networking organizations I've been part of have been working. And It also helps that I work for the state too. So that's been a really helpful, steady stream. Low income stream, but a steady stream that's been able to subsidize my practice. So that's been really nice. And I get to help a lot of people. I've been helping a lot of people, and it feels really good to be doing that. So,
yeah.
You know, I'm just very happy where I'm at right now. Talk to me when I just graduated from law school. I was pulling my hair out. I just had a kid and had a baby on the way and no job prospects. So to be where I'm at right now, it's really nice turnaround.
Awesome. Well, we're certainly glad to be a part of that turnaround and getting that office off the ground, as we've done for many other attorneys. And really we're happy with the work you've been doing for the client so far, and excited to continue the relationship for the long term, and also sharing all the other resources we have available and the community and the network as well. So really glad to have you on board, and I certainly appreciate you taking the time and sharing openly with the processes you have developed.
You guys should have a convention or something like that. Get everybody down and so everybody can meet each other face to face. That'd be a nice thing to do.
It's funny you mentioned that, because we've actually been thinking about doing kind of a, unbundled attorney, conference or mastermind conference where, we post an event for, 2-3 days and have everyone get a chance to meet each other. And, that's really the idea behind the way we used to do the mastermind calls, was have people participate live on live webcam and so forth, but certainly in person as well, where we could do some kind of a retreat and also just share ideas, share concepts, share strategies, just in the way we're doing with the podcast. So that, because ultimately, for us to really as a group make a difference in the amount of folks that are able to access legal services in the country, we all have to work together and share ideas and share resources and share strategies as a cooperative alliance, so that we can all utilize the best strategies to serve the most folks.
And the exclusivity aspect of unbundled makes that very easy to do, because you don't feel like you're helping the people that are helping you are not your competitors. So that's a really nice place to be coming from. That's very effective.
Yep, absolutely. Well, it was certainly one of the reasons why we use that model, right from the get go, from day one. So that's and also it's one client, one attorney. You're creating that one relationship to worry about. Four other lawyers calling them, at the same time, and you're scrambling and competing and so forth. You have the opportunity to really dial in that relationship, build that relationship with the client, and also, like you're talking about, start to connect with the other attorneys we have in our network as well, and continue to hone the craft.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, hey, thanks again for jumping on today and sharing the ideas, and again, looking forward to continue working with you over the coming months and so forth, and dialing things in. And for everyone else that's listening on the call, I want to thank everyone for joining, and we will see you all on the next episode.
All right, Dave, thank you very much. Have a wonderful day.
For more information about how our lead generation services can help you grow your practice, visit our website at www.unbundledattorney.com. And if you're enjoying this podcast, please be sure to subscribe so you get each new episode as soon as it's available, and leave us a rating and a review on iTunes. Once again, thanks for listening.